From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Most American children have not been physically in school since March. And now, school districts are struggling with how to reopen school this fall as COVID infection rates continue to rise in the United States. The story, though, is different internationally. Some nations have found ways to reopen their schools. So we are going to do some globetrotting today, Europe, the Middle East, Asia, and South America, to see if we can pick up a few lessons on how other countries have managed to get their kids back in classrooms. And we'll begin today in Finland. Emmy Saarivikivi joins us from Finland. She is a pediatrician and infectious disease epidemiologist at the National Institute for Health and Welfare in Finland. She's also part of a working group which helps to create guidelines regarding the reopening of Finnish schools. Dr. Saarivikivi, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you.
So first of all, tell us, Finnish schools are still in summer break. So is there a plan to open them up when the end of August arrives?
Yeah, actually mid-August. The semester starts mid-August.
Okay, and, so the plan is to open the schools again. Then what will school look like?
Well, first of all, I mean the COVID situation in Finland is pretty different from what it is in the US. So we have very calm situation at the moment and not very much circulating virus in the population. So it's a different issue. And if the situation stays like this, the schools are going to be opened in mid-August. We did some guidelines for the schools during the spring and the school closures. The schools were closed from mid-March till mid-May and then reopened for just about 2.5 weeks in the end of May. And that was schools were advised to not let any individuals symptomatic to schools, and of course, I mean, physical distancing was recommended, and no gatherings. And then the classes were separated as kind of cohorts to minimize interaction during school days between these groups. And then, of course, the hygiene measures.
So, if I may just jump in here just to recap what you said. So, first of all, the most important thing, as you mentioned, is the infection rate in Finland is very, very low now, right? I'm seeing as of July, the 20th of July, there were only roughly 10 new reported cases across the whole nation of Finland.
That's great.
But yeah, so that's, I think that's the biggest and most salient difference here. But even given that, there are, you just described interesting measures, safety measures that will be in place in August, including, like you said, physical distancing, and I believe sort of keeping classes or pods apart, sanitation. I mean, these are all things that I think people are familiar with, which in terms of the accepted minimum practices. I'm also wondering, though, Doctor, if I may, are there sort of, I don't know how to say this, like cultural differences in terms of how kids get to school and things like that, that are just different in Finnish schools than they are in the United States?
Yeah, sure. I mean, here it's very common that the children walk to schools or take their bikes, or and the schools are typically very close to where people live. So we don't have actually school buses like you do, and the means of getting in closed spaces like in buses, that doesn't happen as much here. And we are a very small country with few people and lots of space. So that's of course a difference for at least in the big cities in the US. So it's probably very different. Also, the school days are quite short here, typically like 4 to 6 hours for children under 12 years or so. And I'm sure there are other differences as well.
And will children have to wear masks?
No, we are not recommending masks at the moment. We kind of count on this cohorting. We do the same way as Norway has been doing, as in Sweden they don't use masks either. We just felt that in this epidemiological situation, it's not really clear if the masking is very efficient. And when you talk about children, they probably won't use the masks as they should. And then we decided not to give that recommendation.
I see. And how are Finnish teachers viewing the prospect of going back into the classroom?
Well, they were very worried in the spring before the schools opened, we have a very long summer break, so there hasn't been much discussion about that at the moment, but I think people are worried how it will affect the situation when people start to gather more and schools open and so forth.
I see.
But as they looked at the situation in Sweden, we haven't done that. We don't have that kind of data on people's professions that we could link like the Swedish people did. But actually, when they looked at teachers as a profession and the other professions, they didn't see any difference between the professions. So and Sweden has had schools opened all the time. So I think that's quite convincing evidence that it's not so. The risk is not that big.
So just to underscore a couple of things. One is again, I just can't say this enough. The infection rate in Finland is extremely low. And two, if I have this correct, in Finland, the law is that children have to go to school. So I don't even think remote learning is necessarily an option there, which possibly sort of encouraged the country to find ways to get kids back into classroom in the next several weeks. So those differences between Finland and the U.S. in mind, do you think that there are any lessons or any examples that Finland provides to the United States?
Well, I think the situation is so different at the moment that I don't dare to say that there would be any lessons to be learned from our experience, but we are of course following the situation very very closely when the schools will open, and we will do very carefully contact tracing and follow up the situation so that we would learn more about the benefits of school closures or if there is a difference between the keeping schools closed or opened, at least in these circumstances we have.
Well, I would say that the one lesson that we could learn from Finland and many other countries is get that infection rate down, right? Test and trace. And then the rest of society sort of falls into place. Well, Dr. Emmi Sarvikki, joining us today from Helsinki, Finland, thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, so that's a great example from Finland in how it looks like they're going to be able, at least for now, to get kids back in the classroom. Let's now move to Israel, to Jerusalem specifically, where Ronit Calderon-Margalit joins us. She's a public health physician and a professor of epidemiology at the Hadassah Hebrew University Brown School of Public Health. Now, last spring, she and other physicians presented a proposal to Israel's health ministry, which suggested schools open in a controlled manner. Dr. Calderon-Margalit, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, your suggestion to open schools in Israel in a controlled manner, is that what happened?
Well, it happened for 2 weeks, and then it all kind of collapsed. In the beginning, what we suggested, what we recommended, was to have the younger children, the preschools and up to the age of 10, go back to school in a more spacious manner. In Israel, usually the classes are very crowded, so we recommended of having them spaced apart from each other, and to have only them in schools in a way that will allow to spread classes, to split them into halves, so each half class will get her own room, its own room, and and it worked very well for 2 weeks. And then the government decided to open the whole education system in a full, to its full scale. So that was lost. And we went back,
in full capacity. So you went back to full capacity briefly, if you could just tell me in 30 seconds, then what happened?
So that happened on May 17th. And then on the week, a week later, there was a heat wave. So originally, all children, the older children from the fourth grades onward, were supposed to come with masks to school. But the week later, there was a very severe heat wave, and this demand for masks it was taken off, and so masks were taken off. And then by the end of that week, we saw a surge. There was an outbreak, and we don't really know if the outbreak started in schools or whether the schools just mirrored the outbreak that happened outside the schools. But there was a huge outbreak that, at least the face of it, was middle and high schools.
So, Doctor, can you just stand by for a second? Because this is really interesting, and I'd like to explore this more with you when we come back. We just have to take a quick break. We are talking right now, we're globetrotting this hour to several countries around the world to learn what they've done to try to get schools reopened as the global COVID pandemic continues. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com. Code POD.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we are once again talking about how to reopen schools, but we're looking around the world, Europe, the Middle East, Asia, South America, to see if there's any lessons we can draw from countries who have tried or will be soon trying to do the same thing. And I'm speaking right now with Dr. Ronit Calderon-Margalit. She's a public health physician and a professor of epidemiology at the Hadassah Hebrew University Brown School of Public Health. She's with us from Jerusalem. And Dr. Calderon-Margalit, you were telling us the story of how initially in May, Israeli schools opened in this controlled manner that you were talking about, sort of a very COVID-conscious manner, if I might say. And then a couple of weeks later, was it the Israeli government just decided to open all schools completely and remove social distancing? Is that what happened?
Yes, it happened in parallel with opening of restaurants and bars. So it's not really clear what really caused this. What we are now in the middle of a second wave of a huge number of cases, and so we do not know whether the opening of schools was the driver of this outbreak. I'm not so sure that this is the case, because really the whole society, kind of the economy, opened up. And I do believe that we do need to let children study, because apparently children are not the driver of this epidemic. And young children, if they are at home, parents cannot go to work, and then that really drives the economy down, and it really imposes a huge burden, especially on people of lower social class and on single parents. So.
Right. Right. I mean, we're living that same reality here in the United States, as you well know. But it's interesting to see. I take your point that Israel sort of reopened up everything, and we can't just look to schools as the nexus of why that second wave of infections started rising in Israel. But I think it seems like an important lesson is you have to maintain. You can't just like magically reopen everything, including schools, that Israel's showing us what will happen. It's happened here in the United States already.
Absolutely. I agree. And the current plan for next year, so the policy for next year is not totally clear, but it seems that at least for the younger children, they will come back to social distancing. And for the older ones, currently, the plan is to have them either doing like shifts or having, you know, hybrid lessons. So part of the classes will be done online, and parts will be done really face to face in classes. So there will be some kind of social distancing, but otherwise, I don't see how can it work. Yeah.
Right. And as a pediatrician, then tell me a little bit more about what you recommend, because here's why I asked, doctor. The impact of this pandemic is so multifaceted, right? And we're like, societies are trying to find the lowest risk solution to getting kids back into school, getting families back to work, while also holding infection rates down. So, I mean, do you think that especially for young kids, it's important to try as hard as we can to get them back in the classroom?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that for the children, it's very important both that they will get not only the education. Well, education, you know, when it's universal, in a way, it lowers gaps in the society. But it's also important because the social connections are very important. The social interactions are hugely important for all children at all ages. And also at home, some of the children are exposed to domestic violence, and some of them are also exposed to malnutrition. So the schools, in a way, are kind of a safety net for many of the children. It's hugely important for all children. And, of course, for their families as well. And I think that in a cautious manner, in a controlled manner, we can have it both. And really, so the COVID-19, we have the COVID-19 itself, but we have so many other aspects that are being harmed during this pandemic. And we have to think how to have this holistic view of how to tackle all facets, as you said.
Well, it seems that one of the lessons there from Israel's experience is don't just presume after a couple of weeks that everything's finished and magic and wave a wand and reopen.
Yeah, and that was against our recommendation. We really wanted also to, and it's my suggestion that, where there is a height or a peak of disease, of outbreak, maybe you could delay the reopening, but everywhere else you could reopen in a controlled manner and it will be fine. I mean, we do go to work and we do have our social interactions, so I think children should have that as well, at least that.
Well, Dr. Ronit Calderon-Margalit, public health physician and a professor of epidemiology at Hadassah Hebrew University Braun School of Public Health, joining us from Jerusalem. Thank you so very much.
Thank you so much for having me, and good luck to all of us.
We're going to need it. Well, let's go to Seattle now. Seattle, Washington, where Brandon Guthrie joins us. He's an assistant professor of global health and epidemiology at the University of Washington. Early in July, he compiled data on 15 countries and their school reopening strategies, and he did that for Washington State's Department of Health. Professor Guthrie, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me on.
So I really appreciate you joining us today as we sort of do this survey of a couple of nations around the world. First and foremost, big picture, what are the lessons, I think the most important lesson that you might draw from other nations' work and attempts to reopen schools?
Yeah, first of all, I want to really recognize that this is such a critically important topic, and it's a really emotional topic, and it's very frustrating to be in a situation of having to make decisions on a short time frame with really limited information. So I think it is important to think about what other countries have done and try to learn from them as much as possible. And you know, one thing is clear, there is no perfect model or comparison to what we're facing here in the United States. I think we can use what other countries have done to help us to build, form some building blocks for what we might do if we were to decide to reopen schools in some form or in some setting. So I think both of your previous speakers really highlighted the two ends of the spectrum. What has been done in countries with quite low community transmission, and what has happened in places like Israel, where maybe at the time that they did reopen schools, they had relatively low transmission, but at the same time, they opened up lots of things and they saw a resurgence. So a lot of countries that have chosen to reopen schools have done so in a limited manner by reducing class sizes, accomplishing that in a number of ways by either bringing back only older students or younger students, or by doing alternate days or alternate shifts. Yeah. That's one of the main strategies that's been taken.
So do you know, if I can just step in here for a second, I feel like the Finland-Israel juxtaposition is really interesting, because you're exactly right. In Finland, they're possibly heading down the path to success here, because they're transmission rate is so very low, even on a per capita rate there right now. I mean, it's hovering just above the zero line. But in Israel, what was interesting, what Margalit said, which was interesting, was that they began in a controlled manner to reopen schools, but then all of a sudden the government decided to reopen the entire economy. And on top of that, because of that heat wave, they relaxed the mask wearing provisions. And I think it's one of those multivariate problems that shows me and possibly hopefully other Americans that even just on the point of masks, do you think that if we just got this country, everyone in this country, to wear masks as much as they possibly could, that could go a long way to helping us be able to reopen schools come September?
I think that there is really increasing evidence in support of the value of masks. And, you know, we don't have great data from school-based settings in terms of there's no reason to think that if they were used perfectly, that the efficacy of mask wearing to prevent onward transmission among those who are maybe symptomatic, but hopefully either pre-symptomatic or asymptomatic. The big question, I think, is can they be worn appropriately and consistently in the school setting? And I think that is something that we should put a lot of energy into, you know, maximizing that potential. I think that the example of Israel and the masking and then relaxing masking, while it's not definitive, it does give some circumstantial evidence that the masks may be providing some benefit. And I think if you're talking about classrooms, even at reduced classroom volumes, the more that we are finding emerging evidence that there may be an important aerosol component to transmission, that even if you have classrooms that are sufficiently spaced apart, if they're in an enclosed space for an extended period of time, In the absence of wearing masks, there could be some potential for transmission. Again, that's there, we don't have definitive evidence of that, but I think it just it further emphasizes the importance of looking at masks as an important piece. I want to really also bring us around to talking about, you know, I think a lot of the focus has been on the students. I think we really also need to think about the teachers themselves. And yes. Many of the examples where you see masks in schools, the teachers aren't wearing the masks. And I think that's a really, it's understandable. People don't like talking with masks on. But there are great examples, some from Israel, where we have evidence that the teachers themselves were the people who are transmitting infection. So highlighting two things there, I think. One, the importance of teachers and staff wearing masks, but also that critical importance of as much as possible keeping class groups, including teachers, encapsulated or in groups that mix as little as possible with other groups.
Right. Well, if you can just hang on here for a second, I want to now go and check in with Asia, specifically Japan. And Simon Denyer joins us. He's with us from Tokyo. He's the Washington Post's bureau chief in Tokyo, covering Japan and also the Korean Peninsula. Simon, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much, Magna.
So what is the status of school opening in Tokyo or Japan more largely?
Schools reopened in Japan towards the end of May, the beginning of June, initially in a very sort of controlled manner with staggered kids going on staggered days so that half the class would be in on Monday and the other half the class would be in on Tuesday. But gradually over the last few weeks, that's been relaxed. So we're now in a situation that the school year was extended actually to make up for lost time. We're now in a situation where this semester is ending, but kids are back in classes which are essentially full-size classes, albeit they're spaced out as much as possible.
Full-sized classes, do they have sort of safety measures in place, distancing measures in place?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the first point, and the first very obvious point for us in Japan, we've all been wearing masks since February, and you know, whenever we go out, and we've kind of been looking at the rest of the world, Asia, I think East Asia has been looking at the rest of the world, just thinking, why has it taken so long for this message to get across? You know, it seems so obvious to people here that mask wearing was an essential part of it. So yes, you go to school, the children are all wearing masks. The teachers are wearing masks even when they're delivering the lessons. So, you know, that's an essential part of it. You know, I went to an elementary school. So lunchtime, they were worried that children would be talking to each other and, you know, at lunch and conversation, that wouldn't be a good idea. So the children have lunch sitting at their desks. Now, you know, for the kids, that's pretty lonely. They weren't that happy about it, you know, because it's boring, right? But it means that there isn't that risk of transmission at lunchtime, which is important. Temperature checks, so the parents have to check children's temperature before they go to school. Actually, in South Korea, in some schools they have a Chinese-made robot which checks children's temperature as they come into school in the morning. But generally speaking, it's the parents.
How does that work? How does the robot do that?
It scans, you know, it has a scanner. So as the kids walk past, it scans there. It's got a temperature sensor, so it scans them and would alert the teachers if there's any children whose are showing a fever. I mean, there are all kinds of ways, but basically, you know, extensive checks to make sure if the kids are feeling unwell, they're immediately isolated. And just a final point: your previous guests have been talking about masks and wearing them outdoors. It's hot here in Japan right now. So children will wear masks indoors, but not necessarily outdoors. We had some reports of some children in China who actually apparently died after wearing masks outdoors during sort of exercise. So they're aware of that in the school that I went to. And if children go outdoors, they're allowed to take their masks off. But then, even more important, they have to keep distance from each other when they're outside.
Mm. Now, I'm going to presume also that, of course, sanitation measures are in place. Are there sort of plexiglass dividers between students? I mean, how much distancing are we talking about?
Right. I mean, in some schools, not in the school in Japan that I visited, in some schools in South Korea, there are plexiglass screens between desks, but actually not in most of them, I understand. You know, there are lines, so the children have to wash their hands when they come in the morning. And so there are lines, there are marks on the floor to show them where to stand when they're lining up to do that. When they're collecting something from the teacher, they have to line up. And again, there are marks on the floor. But, you know, children are children, right? So they don't take that much notice of those lines if they're 5 years old, you know.
So I just have 1 minute left with you, Simon. And for my last question, I'm looking at Japan's new daily case numbers, and I see they've been creeping up over the past, looks like, couple of weeks in July. Is there a concern in Japan that they might have to close schools down again? I mean, what might happen next?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a parent, so my daughter's been at home for the last 4 months, and I'm worried that when her, you know, that she's due to go back in a few weeks, and I'm worried about whether that's going to happen. So there is a concern, absolutely. The government is not closing businesses right now. It doesn't want to go back to a lockdown. So we shall see, but they don't want to close things down.
Yeah. Well, Simon Denyer, Washington Post bureau chief in Tokyo covering Japan and the Korean Peninsula. Simon, this was absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And Brandon, if you can just hang on for one moment, we've got a lot more to talk about when we come back from this break. We are looking at how schools internationally are opening and what we can learn from it. This is On Point.
Every day in America, 60 million packages are delivered. But we don't always know what's inside.
He bent down to pick the package up. That's when the device detonated.
Danger is everywhere, and no one is safe in Austin, Texas, as law enforcement hunts a serial bomber for 19 days. From Sony Music Entertainment, Campside Media, and Pegalo Pictures, this is Witnessed. 19 Days. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts to binge all episodes or listen weekly wherever you get your podcasts.
Smart journalism. Fascinating topics. Words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking about schools again and how to reopen them as the COVID pandemic continues to rage on in the United States. But today we're looking at what other countries are doing or have done to get kids back in classrooms and what lessons we here in the United States can learn from that. And I'm joined today by Brandon Guthrie. He's an assistant professor of global health and epidemiology at the University of Washington. Earlier this month, he compiled data on about 15 countries and their school reopening strategies for the state of Washington's Department of Health. And Professor Guthrie, you know, we've talked about masks, we've talked about distancing, we've talked about even sort of, obviously, sanitation within schools. I'm wondering what you think about testing. That's actually something that hasn't necessarily come up in our previous conversations with other countries. Should school-based testing be a part of any reopening strategy?
I think that's a great question. We have very little evidence from any other countries that have instituted testing as part of their school reopening plans. In Germany, it's been done on a small scale. But to my knowledge, there's nowhere else that has done that. You know, you're talking about massive amounts of tests, depending on how you chose to implement such a strategy. I think given what we're seeing right now in terms of our testing capacity, even if you were to develop a plan, I think it would be challenging to implement it at the point that we are now. If you could come up with much cheaper, much more rapid tests, even if they're imperfect in their sensitivity and specificity, but if you could make up for it in volume, there could be potentially some benefits. I think that aside from testing or screening as part of control measures, I do think to the extent that districts do choose to open, I think that it's really important that as a scientific community, we seek to understand what happens in those environments. And testing will be an important part of that. So whether that be doing surveillance on maybe a limited basis for active infection, or trying to understand using antibody tests, what happens over time as schools reopen, I think that is critically important.
Interesting. So in your survey of 15 countries, I'm almost hesitant to ask this because the pandemic conditions in the United States right now are so bad that it's almost, it's a comparison possibly not even worth making. Like, we just have to get the pandemic under control first. But that said, are there one or two countries that you would look to and say, you know what, they're doing it right, and if we can get to where country X is, then maybe we have a shot at this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that I think there are important lessons to be learned from an implementation standpoint from Denmark and Norway in terms of how they have chosen to open schools. And I think one of the really critical lessons from those places is that they chose to reopen school for younger children, elementary school age children, and that is partly because they want to create more space, and one of the ways to create more space is to limit the number of children that you are reopening schools for, and you can do that by age stratifying. The choice to go with younger children is also really driven by two things. One, although the evidence is not perfect, it appears that younger children are at considerably lower risk of acquiring SARS-CoV-2 infection. So estimates in the range of, half the level of risk, maybe even a third the level of risk of infection. If younger children become infected, they're less likely to develop symptoms and less likely to develop severe illness compared to adults. And although the data are not as clear on this topic, it does look like elementary school age children are also considerably less likely to transmit infection if they become infected. So that's what we know about their risk profile in terms of the virus. We also know that these younger children are much less able to learn in an online setting. And the burden on parents to support that learning and to provide the day-to-day childcare really has a critically important burden on them in terms of their ability to work.
Mm. Well, full disclosure, if you hear me sigh deeply, it's because I'm intimately familiar with the challenges that you just talked about regarding young children and remote education. So hang on here for just a second, because we've looked at examples in Europe, in the Middle East, in Asia. I want to bring in one more person to help us understand what's happening in a particular country in South America. Emiliana Vegas joins us. She's a senior fellow and director of the Center for Universal Education at the Brookings Institution, and she's been following how countries have reopened their schools and looking specifically at Uruguay. Emiliana, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Magna. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So tell us briefly a little, or just tell us a little bit about how is Uruguay doing? Will or are schools open there?
Yes, well, Uruguay started reopening schools around June 1st. And the strategy there was to reopen first the schools that are in rural areas. Just for your audience and as a way of background, Uruguay is a fairly small nation in the very southern part of South America. It has 3.4 million people, so it's not hugely populated. But half of the schools in the entire country are in rural areas, and they have lower, of course, numbers of students. So they started there where they could implement social distancing guidelines. They required students to wear masks. And by the end of June, all schools in the country, both primary and secondary schools, had reopened with strict protocols. One of the differences from what I'm hearing and what I myself have been following from other countries is that also, you know, with the rationale of having smaller groups of students at one time, they divided the population of students in schools. And instead of doing it, let's say, in shifts during the same day, they have students coming for in-person instruction 2 days a week. Two consecutive days a week, I might add. So, for example, a group will come Monday and Tuesday, and then the rest of the school, that's half of the school, will come on Monday and Tuesday, and they will socially distance so they have more space within the building to do so. And then the other half of the school will come Thursday and Friday. And they use Wednesdays to allow teachers to have time to prepare, to support children who may need special supports for their learning, and also to deeply clean the school building.
So can I ask, this is interesting. So they're doing sort of a, it sounds like a hybrid approach, if I can put it that way for now. And this is even though it seems, if I'm looking at the COVID curve here for Uruguay, that it's been sort of relatively flat-ish with some spikes for the past couple of months. So do they have the pandemic more broadly in Uruguay as a nation? I don't want to say under control, but have they been managing it?
Yes. That's true as well. They have very much been proactively managing it. They didn't have as strict a lockdown as other countries in the region, or even as you know, many states here in the United States. But they did appeal to people's common sense, ask them to stay at home, wear masks. And in fact, their rates never really got out of control. I don't think they've reached, 1,000 deaths during the whole period. And once they reopened schools, they kept monitoring the situation very closely. And only in one particular district, they found a spike in cases. And that's a district that borders Brazil. And so they closed the schools just in that district for a period, and they've since reopened them as well.
I was going to just ask about that because, of course, Uruguay is bordered by both Argentina and Brazil, right? The big heavyweights in South America, and particularly in this case, Brazil, right? That's having a completely different story regarding COVID in that country. So it makes a lot of sense that perhaps there's some porousness on the Uruguayan-Brazilian border. But the reason why I asked about the cautious approach that it sounds like Uruguay is taking with its schools is they've chosen that cautious approach even though it seems that they have been able to thus far manage the pandemic. So there's no... There hasn't yet been this desire to say, okay, well, we've got this under control. Let's more fully reopen schools.
That's true. I should also mention that Uruguay, about over 10 years ago, began investing in providing laptops and tablets to all students. So they started one of the earliest, let's say, adopters of the one-to-one device as a way of also connecting the entire country to kind of Wi-Fi. And so they are in a situation that many countries, and even in the U.S., many communities, don't have the level of access to devices and internet that Uruguay has. So I think the fact that they had started that program and that they were already basically using blended learning as a way of operating, not to the extent that they've had to move to. Of course, it wasn't 50%, let's say, of blended learning versus in-person instruction, but the community, the school community, was very accustomed to, regularly using devices for learning.
So fascinating. Brandon, let me turn back to you. What are some important lessons or observations that you draw from the Uruguayan example?
Yeah, I think that, you know, really having a plan and having contingencies in place, I think as we saw from the Uruguay example, but also from Israel, I think we see some examples of what happens if you choose to reopen schools, you know, precipitously and don't anticipate. I think you have to anticipate that there are going to be challenges, there are going to be setbacks, and really thinking through what are you going to do in those scenarios.
So let me ask you both this question. Given the fact that, you know, I'm thinking of Florida, Texas, certain states, even California, all over again, the community spread is pretty rampant in several states in the United States right now. Should we actually be considering an entirely different scenario here in the United States, which is just not opening schools until the pandemic is under control, Brandon?
Well, I'm not really in a position to make recommendations about what districts should and shouldn't do. I think that, you know, individual school districts are probably in the best position with support from their public health agencies to make those decisions. I think that we, as a public health community, can provide guidance about what if districts choose to open, what measures are likely to be the most productive in terms of doing it safely.
Emiliana, what do you think?
Well, I'm not a health expert, so I agree with Brendan that, you know, and what we've seen, countries across the world that have reopened successfully have had a real true partnership with the health authorities and have had a lot of guidance from the health authorities. So I think that that's step one. I do want to highlight that schools play a very important role, not only in, you know, providing learning opportunities, but also in socio-emotional development for children and youth, and especially for children and youth who don't have, you know, safe and adequate environments to learn at home. I think, you know, it would be wise to prioritize opening at least some schools to provide safe learning spaces and a safe you know, space and time for students to process everything that's happening. And I'm just concerned about the lasting impacts of the school closures on this generation of students.
So if, I hope you both forgive me for a second, but I just want to express a little bit of frustration, not with you, but with where we are in this country right now, because it seems as if, from what I've heard across this hour, the lessons that we should be drawing are, we've known what to do from the start, right? I mean, you heard Simon say that over in Asia, they're wondering what took people so long, that we should have been testing, we should have been tracing, we should have had perhaps more rigid lockdowns, wearing masks, that we actually would not be in this situation regarding trying to balance risks for regarding the harm done to our kids for staying out of school versus the harm potentially done by this pandemic. So I think it's fair to say that a lot of people are feeling this frustration. But now we have you know, possibly 4 to 6 weeks in some places to look ahead to see what to do. I'm wondering, not asking you about schools in particular, but because schools are basically reflections of the communities that they're in, should we actually be focusing on right now about getting the pandemic under control in those communities? Now, and that perhaps that could lead to doors opening in schools in the fall, Brandon.
I think we should absolutely be focusing on that. And I think that you're right to be frustrated. I think the one thing that we have seen from this pandemic that does work is when we reduce mobility, when we limit physical contact in settings where transmission can happen, that we see dramatic declines in transmission. We saw that when we had wide-scale lockdowns. I doubt that that's going to happen again in many places in the U.S. for many reasons. I think we should be frustrated that we squandered all of the hard work that we did starting in March to drive down numbers. And I think the lessons that we really should learn from this is that when you don't pay attention to guidance from public health, you will see transmissions emerging. And I think you're right. I think we need to find ways to address learning needs of our kids while also protecting our communities.
Well, with that, we have to wrap up today. Brandon Guthrie, Assistant Professor of Global Health and Epidemiology at the University of Washington, thank you so very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on. This has been a great opportunity.
And Amelia Vega, Senior Fellow and Co-Director of the Center for Universal Education at the Brookings Institution. Emiliana, thank you so much for joining us. I'd love to have you back because I know you have a report coming out sometime soon about beyond reopening. So I hope you can come back for that.
I would love to. Thank you, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.